Vodka o'clock.
Hey everyone, it is Amber Love and it is Vodka O'Clock podcast, and of course coming to you from amberunmasked.com. Today my returning guest is Ryan Lindsay. You know him officially as Ryan K. Lindsay. Don't forget we are labeled as an explicit website and podcast, so if you're easily offended or under 18, this is probably not the place for you. Now there might be some minor spoilers in today's discussion, but probably not too much. I don't think we're going to get into anything that would ever wreck the story for anybody. So Ryan, welcome to the show. Cheers.
Hey, nice. Thanks for having me back. It's really nice to be here, and it's nice to be reminded that we are explicit, so we can, really have a good fucking chat.
Yeah, exactly. Well, last time was mostly a lot of talk about My Little Ponies, so I don't think we got anywhere explicit there.
Oh, that can get explicit. You just need to know the secret cheat codes to put into Google.
Yeah. I mean, that's a different kind of show. I did see that there is a Bronies documentary available on Netflix.
I've heard about this. Yeah, I've seen a few people saying that it's interesting.
I haven't seen it yet.
I don't know. I've really gone on record as saying I love the Bronies. I think they're awesome.
Yeah.
Their enthusiasm and I'm really hoping that they will passionately flock to Headspace and pick it up from Comixology this week. Surely.
That's awesome. Yeah, I hope so too. I mean, they could not be more different.
No.
But you know, when you've established a fan base, regardless of your range.
Yeah.
Of genre, hopefully the fans follow you there.
That's the plan. Because if I can bring pony sales numbers to Headspace, I will be a happy man.
That would be pretty awesome.
Would
you know,
insane.
Then you'd be as famous as that Katie Cook.
Well, maybe never as famous as her. She's big league, and for due reason, she's pretty amazing too.
She really is. She's delightful. She's just so fun to get to know and to follow on social media with her ridiculous stories of being a parent. And
I like
know.
That. I like that she has the parent chat too. It makes me feel not so sort of isolated in having crazy kid adventures. That's for sure.
Yeah. Was the child able to provide you any material? Because Headspace does focus on a lot of sort of imaginary things going on that we're going to get into. And I didn't know if, like, because sometimes I feel like I've lost my imagination.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, it's there. It's just waiting for you to use it, I guarantee. Sometimes you just need to work to unlock it. And I found I did that with Headspace because, it comes out this weekend, so it's about Carpenter Cove, this small town where the inhabitants... They're just sort of there. It's like almost like a purgatory. They don't really know what's going on, but they just sort of get on with it. And it's this really weird sort of ethereal place. And then it comes out that it's actually the town is a construct inside the mind of the killer and that the government has established it there. And so what that allowed me to do was anything that I wanted with Carpenter Cove. I can literally do anything with it because it's an imaginary landscape. And so I constantly had to remind myself, go crazy, get gonzo, just do whatever you want in there. And that's why in the first issue we've got Eric Zawadzki, our artist on the majority of pages. He just really cut loose with inventing some monsters and just throwing, weird stuff into the background, which I like.
Yeah, you really did, because I had noticed on your Twitter avatar, I couldn't figure out what it was, and then once I took a look at the issue, I was like, it's the weird cyborg dog robot bartender.
Yes, Gil. I love Gil. He is a favorite of mine from this issue, poor little guy, and he's having some problems. And
I was
one of those ones where I was like, oh, do you reckon we could do this? And then Eric, he drew it up, and I was like, oh, man, I'm so in love.
It's so great. Good.
Yeah, so I found I really had to just sit there and go, all right, how can I make this scene still serve the story, but just be a little wacky? Like, what's the point of having a dream landscape and not using it? So yeah, we messed stuff up, which is pretty cool.
See, I was wondering if Carpenter Cove was fictitious and you just went wild in it. You know, like some writers will take a real town, and just go ballistic. Like Stephen King, I think he uses real cities, right?
Yeah.
And, a lot of writers do. They'll pick, like, real cities that they're familiar with, but then, throw Godzilla in it.
Yeah.
No,
Carpenter Cove is pure imagination. And I named it I named it after John Carpenter, so...
there we go.
A shout out to a guy who certainly inspired the imagination of my childhood, that's for sure.
Well, I had no idea what was going on. It was literally page by page. I thought it was something else. Like, I thought it was a story, you know, about, I want to say his name was Gavin. Now I can't remember. It was the other guy, the blonde. So I was thinking it was a story about this guy. And then I was like, oh, but now we're starting to focus on the sheriff.
Yeah.
And we're focusing on the sheriff a lot. And, you know, and the whole time I didn't realize that this was, you know, where the Headspace title was coming from until I got to, like, this reveal.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, son of, I'm like, and there's tentacles coming out of the floor and this, you know, monster banging on the door and everything. It's, you know, so... It was one of those things, like, from a writing standpoint, I was going, how in the hell did he do that? Like, how did you like string me along until I figured out, you know, until they you know, make it known that there's a serial killer tie here and, you know, what's happening is not real world.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely wanted to make it layered. I wanted it to be a bit deep, but I'm also, and this may be to my detriment in the end, we'll only really find out by doing it, I like to just assume that the audience will keep up or will want to keep up or will look back and to triple check things. And this is a story where sort of everything means something and you're really going to have to pay attention to little things, to big things, to things you think you understand, and then it turns out to be something else later. And you sort of got to keep a few threads in your head going along. I sort of wanted it to be that. So, yeah, you'll notice that we have Shane the sheriff in Carpenter Cove, which is inside Max's head, and we have that sequence all illustrated by Eric Zawadzki, and then we cut to Max, the actual person who houses Carpenter Cove, and he's in the real world, and his sequence is illustrated by Chris Peterson with Marissa Louise on colors, and they do an amazing job of sort of a different art style, but it all flows. And so we've got these
two, it's really different.
I
was immediately thinking, I'm like, wow, this looks like the Umbrella Academy art.
I've been saying, and I don't know, artists sometimes don't like to be compared to others, and maybe Chris hates it every time I do it, but he's got a really Bar Moon sort of flow to his work. I love it. And I love both art styles, and I love them differently, which is really, like, I'm spoiled on this book, I must admit, 100%. And,
but I think that's important, though. I mean, it's mainly from a reader and fan standpoint. You know, hopefully it's not offending any of the artists, because I did that once. I said that somebody's art was like Oming, and the writer got really upset when I said that because he didn't happen to like Oming, and I'm like, but it really is.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's something that we do to sell the book. It's like when you're standing at your booth and you're trying to pitch to somebody. You know, and you want to say, well, it's like, you know, if the X-Men were cowboys, you know, you take somebody else's property and you make it relatable so that they know what you're talking about. And, you know, something like, you know, an artist who's out there like Gabriel Ba or Mike Mignola or whatever, you know, you take that familiar name and say, if you like that guy, then your eyes might be really drawn to this.
Yeah, absolutely. So I use it as shorthand, but, I mean, I think Chris really brings his own game to it, and having Marissa do the colors over his work, just it really pops for me. But you'll notice between those two sequences, I don't do any sort of centering captions. I don't say, oh, now in real life, and then cut.
Yeah, no, not at all.
I want the readers to sort of keep up. I don't know, I was reading, I think it was the latest issue of Sex Criminals this past week, and I just noticed they don't caption every little bit. Oh, this is... Now, 5 years ago, this is now. They just sort of expect you to keep up, and I like doing that. And I like an author and an artist and a work that appreciates my intellect. And so I'm sort of doing that with Headspace. But hopefully people aren't getting lost to the point where they're like, well, I can't come back to this. That was just, I got no idea. Like it should all be there.
Right. Well, that was the thing that impressed me. You know, when it came to how things were revealing themselves, because it worked so well for me. Whereas, like today, like, I don't know. I mean, I suppose as a critic I can say if I like something or didn't like something. But, like, I checked out a couple issues of Pretty Deadly.
Yeah.
And the art is spectacular.
Yeah.
But the writing, I cannot follow this book. I am and I'm not the only one. Like, I started looking through, like, the letters. They actually have, like, a, you know, not just a letters column, but they, I mean, this is pretty awesome of them to do this. Like, yeah. I don't know if it was Kelly Sue's idea or what, but she put tweets.
Yeah, yeah.
In the back of the book, but she included the critical ones too, the bad ones.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
You know, people saying that I'm too confused by this, and you know, so it was a nice mixed bag where they're like, you know, they're sort of like embracing the criticism, but that's a book where it's not falling together for me, and yet when I read Headspace, I was like, he has this working, and my brain can follow this.
Oh, that's good. That's definitely the plan, especially with the first issue. I think they're so important. And that's why, I mean, we went with the 22 pages for the first issue, and it'll drop down to 12 pages an issue after that, and all of them for 99 cents each. But I really wanted to make sure we packed the big bang in this first one and build the characters and build the places, the locations, especially because Carpenter Cove is so integral to the story. And then hopefully leave you wanting more by the end. I mean, it's every writer admits that's one of the hardest things is building that first issue that works and really makes sure that people come back. So I think it will. I don't know. I'm writing the sort of book that I would want to find on the stands. So it probably sounds dumb as hell, but I'm really happy with this book. It's great.
That's great. it's great. I mean, and you know, it's like there's so much to talk about here because we need to talk about like the art and the visuals and stuff, but I want to talk about the story too. And like I said, we'll try to not really spoil anything.
Yeah.
The actual story contains, because it's taking place in this imaginary world where you're imagining, you know, you've just let everything go wild.
Yeah.
The sheriff is dealing, this is Shane, right?
Yes.
There's futuristic technology and there's monsters. And he's sort of like, he's being really challenged.
Yes.
As the main character. He's like, I've never had to do this before. And, you know, it was interesting to get to that part. Like, wow, you're the sheriff of this town and you've never, you know, it's like, shouldn't you be experienced?
Yeah.
Or something. And he was being really challenged there.
He's just sort of, yeah, he's gone through this existence floating through it. I mean, he talks at the start about no one knows how they got there, and you think they would question and challenge that more, but they kind of haven't. They're just there, and it's just this really, it's like a sort of a fog way of living where they're like, I understand everything that I can see, but as soon as my vision hits the fog that is all around me, I'm just like, oh, well, I guess, you know, too hard basket. Let's just put it away. And yeah, I mean, it's a really sad little town, and it's obviously a sad way of living. So when we open, we find Shane in a really weird place, and
exactly.
Then it becomes a weirder place as sort of like things start basically collapsing in on Carpenter Cove. I mean, I've got Gil, the dog-headed bartender, sort of talking about how Carpenter Cove was this little sort of, he calls it an island in Max's mind, and now Max's mind is collapsing in on it and crushing it. And that's due to an occurrence that Max does in the real world that sort of triggers everything off. So yeah, it's sort of like it's putting Shane in a weird spot and then just making it worse. And yeah, I'm really keen on seeing how he deals with that. And then, I mean, ultimately his goal is to get out. But we layer a few other goals throughout his journey over the coming issues as well. So you know, that's a big thing that I want to do. I want to challenge our lead and make things hard.
Right, and because it's funny, because he seems like those very first couple pages, he's incredibly in control of what's going on, because he's basically like declaring a punishment on one of the citizens of Carpenter Cove, and it comes across as lawless in a way, but more like too much law, like Judge Dredd kind of law.
Yeah, yeah, and that sequence at the start is very important, and will come to bear later and sort of will be explained. And yeah, I'm glad that you sort of noticed that there. He very much knows what he has to do in that situation. And there's very much a reason for that explained later on. That sort of shows how certain things have been structured in Carpenter Cove. And doing this was really difficult, trying to make sure that everything mattered and that everything made sense and that we sort of earned everything. I mean, collaborating with Eric, because we started putting this together over a year ago now. And I would constantly get emails from Eric going, so why does Shane do this? Why does he want to do this? Why wouldn't he do this? And I would have to sort of explain it. And either I would have the answer in my head and I'd just go, oh, it's because of this. And Eric's like, yep, cool. Or I'd be like, oh, you know, shit, I hadn't thought of that. And then we'd work on it, we'd brainstorm. He's got a really good head for story, Eric. Yeah, he was really good to collaborate with at the start. And we spent ages just beating this story into shape. And I don't know how many drafts we went through for the whole synopsis, but we really, really, like, we were kicking every corner to make sure that there were no sort of, you know, leaks for once we set sail. And, yeah, I feel like we've got a really airtight story moving forward, because some more things will be explained next issue, and some big things will be explained in issue 6, and, like, yeah, everything sort of ties together so that the people have the motivation for a reason, and that things in Carpenter Cove happen for a reason. And yeah, we've really tried to stay true to all of that and make sure that, you know, I'm really keen on, and writers especially, earning the things that happen in their stories. It's no good just sort of just going, he gets out of Carpenter Cove because he finds a secret door behind the cupboard. Boom, let's get him out. Like, that's, there needs to be more to it. It needs to have purpose. And we try to really lay out everything together. It takes a lot of pre-work, but it hopefully pays off in the end.
Yeah, the way that you were describing that the world feels like it's starting to collapse in, that's really felt, because you see that things are physically changing in the world, sort of like Inception, you know, like the movie where, like, the pixels start, you know, like, falling apart, the bits start go crazy. I wanted to know if there was, you know, if it was something you thought of, or if you didn't even give any thought to it, but that we have Shane, who is the lead character here, is, you know, a wonderful black man, and he's the sheriff, and there's so much talk about how there's no diversity in comics. There's big uproar because Image Expo was only like a month or so ago.
Yeah.
And there was just like so much diversity lacking at the expo.
Yeah.
Even though there, you know, there, it was just the people who, I guess, who happened to be there. So I, like, to me, when I saw Shane at first, like, it didn't even dawn on me. And then I was like halfway through the book and I was like, oh, you know, I'm like, I wonder if anybody's even going to notice that there's like a black lead character in this comic.
Because you're the first person who's raised it with me, which I was waiting for it because, you know, I initially was like, I'm a white guy. I'm like, am I going to write, you know, a black guy well? Am I going to do it properly? And then, you know what? I found it really easy. I just wrote him as a guy. And I had this discussion on Twitter recently where I was like, if you write, a Mexican person or a black person, how much should their race inform their character? And some people were like, oh, it absolutely should inform everything because they've lived this different life. And I was like, well, maybe some of them have, maybe some of them haven't. And my specific character, you have to make your choice. Did he grow up in the South under vicious racism, or did he grow up, overseas on an army base? Like, there's so many things that inform people that in the end I felt confident writing him. And I lost that fear because I do. I always worry that I'm not going to write a woman well, perhaps, or that I'm not going to write a person of a different background. But in the end I thought, what are the core principles of Shane as a character? And I looked at it, he's a father, he's a sheriff. I'm not a sheriff, but I feel like I can write that. That should be fine. He's got a wife, or he had a wife. And I looked at all those things and said, yeah, I can really sort of touch base with all of those things and write it. As for whether it was a conscious decision, it was, to the degree that once I was sort of initially breaking the story, I realized there didn't need, it was one of those ones, and I think it was Chris Sabila I was talking about this with on Twitter, where he said it, and I completely agree. You ask yourself, does the character need to be white? No. Then if not, why not write something else? Purely because it needs to happen. And I'm not doing it as some sort of calculated ploy. I just did it more as, to be honest, I'm a white Australian guy. There's none of us on the comic page. So I'm not going to write myself in the story. I will be writing somebody else no matter what. So, you know, why not put a black lead in there, just because I think the diversity needs to happen, and you need to make it start somewhere. And I don't know, I think some people sort of talk themselves out of it and go, oh, I'm not going to do it just because, but I don't know, I felt like Shane could have been anybody. So once I got the idea very early of him being, you know, African-American, I just saw him that way for the rest of the story, and it didn't sort of jump out at me anymore. And yeah, nobody else has raised it at all. So whether they're even consciously thinking about it or noticing it, and you said, you know, you sort of, it's not a big thing to think about. You just sort of read through and get on with the story. But yeah, I'm hoping some people do appreciate that we've decided to do something a little bit different.
Yeah, because I like how you said, you know, would it change the character at all? Because I read this really cool article about somebody compiled a list of female roles in Hollywood that had originally been written for men.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They, you know, and these are like really iconic roles. Like, I think Ripley from Alien was on the list.
Yep.
Salt, which is played by Angelina Jolie, was originally supposed to be a man. And, I mean, those are very physically demanding action roles, so I could see those being male characters. But then when you think about that, and then this, I don't know who came up with this concept, but it was really hilarious. If you can replace a female character with a sexy lamp.
Yeah.
Then you have failed in developing a character.
That's what Kelly Sue says. She's like, if you can do that, fuck you.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, well, true. She also, somebody had asked her, I mean, she's been asked many times on the panel, how do you write women? And she was like, write them like a person. And that's
a person.
All
a lot of people say write them like a person, which was why I really, really wanted to like her book, Pretty Deadly.
Yeah.
And I just am having a really hard time because I was like, oh my God, it's like this crazy, you know, supernatural Western, and it's got all these women in it, and it's got this really, you know, awesome, powerful little girl who's got, you know, there's something really intriguing about the little girl character. And I'm just, you know, and I was really confused by it, but I do love, you know, she gives, you know, some amazing advice, and some people have, you know, they've quoted her so much.
Yeah, it's just part of the general industry sort of advice knowledge now, some of the things that she said. And I like it. It's one of those things where it just, I don't know if people are afraid to do it, or whether they're just like, oh, no, I'll just write what I know, and I'll write a white lead, or what the case is, and I won't write a woman. But I don't know, I'm certainly just trying to branch out there, because it's fun to explore different points of view, and it's interesting to challenge yourself as a writer and sort of put that out there. And I mean, if you look at like Ripley from the Alien franchise, that role could totally be a guy or a girl, because there's no, I don't feel, gender specific part to it, and there's certainly no reason why it couldn't be a woman. And as you can see, a woman played that role, and Sigourney Weaver kicked ass in it. Like, you can have an action lead that kicks ass in this female. Like, that's believable, because women can kick ass. And I don't know why we get stuck in looking at it and being like, oh, no, we can't do that. Oh, no, it would, you know, this character wouldn't be able to do that role, because he'd be so crippled by racism that he wouldn't be able to get on with the job, and she'd be so female that she wouldn't be able to lift heavy things. And it's garbage. Like, it's totally unnecessary. And, I don't know. I just sort of think, like, I've seen a lot of people with Young Avengers talking about how there's what's her name, Miss America. Is that her name? Miss America, and she's I think she's Mexican in descent. The amount of people that have sort of written to Kieran Gillen and been like, it's great to read a superhero that that looks like me, and Miles Morales, the Ultimate Spider-Man.
Right.
People are like, this is great. There's a character that looks like me, and I go to the comic shop, and there's no characters that look like me, and I just think that'd suck. Like,
well, it's something new coming out because, like you said, sometimes you can do it as, you know, as a creator, because it's not going to do anything and affect the story.
Yeah.
So why not add that? Or you can do it specifically to affect the story, like the new Ms. Marvel,
yeah,
where I believe it's G. Willow Wilson is going to introduce a Muslim, a young girl,
yeah,
in the role of Ms. Marvel. And she's, you know, she's got this really adorable outfit. Like, I really like,
yeah,
it, because it's very, it's all covered up and modest and everything, but it still looks like a girl's outfit.
Yeah.
Like, she's not, it's like, it's, and I think it's, it, you know, it will hopefully surprise people. It certainly surprised them when the announcement came out, because people were wondering why, like, you know,
yeah,
what was this going to do? What does a superhero being a Muslim do? Well, I don't know. Let's find out.
Yeah. Like, why not give it a crack? And some people say, oh, you're just doing it to do it. And so that I sort of respond, well, good. That's how change happens, consciously. You can't just hope that unconsciously things will sort of, you know, change. You have to get in there and just say, oh, no, I'm going to do this specifically. Like, I've looked at roles and gone, does this have to be male? Can I change that? You'll notice in Headspace, he sort of, as the event occurs where Max ends up affecting Carpenter Cove, and Shane gets all of his real-world memories back very suddenly, and we have a page where he's sort of remembering things from the real world. You'll notice that his wife is not black. So they're an interracial couple. And
right,
I did that very consciously again, because why not? It's like, it actually happened the week where, there was an American food. I want to say it was Doritos, but I know it wasn't Doritos.
Oh, was it Cheerios?
Yes.
The Cheerios,
yes,
commercial?
Yeah,
yeah,
yes.
The Cheerios commercial. Yeah.
That all went down, and I just sent Eric an email, and I was like, it's not crass or cashing in or anything. If we just make his wife a white lady, can we do that? And he was like, let's do it. And I'm like, all right, cool. Like, purely because why not? Because it doesn't affect the story. It's just one of those things where I thought, here's an opportunity to do what I feel is like very little work on our part. And it can hopefully make a big difference to somebody where they go, oh, there you go, our relationship.
I hope that, I mean, but I hope that happens with, you know, with gay characters too.
Yeah.
You know, because I was trying to work on a pitch, and I was, you know, it was one of those things where it was, you know, a love triangle was presenting itself, and I'm like, why don't I just make this three dudes?
Yeah.
You know, like, what's, you know, like, hopefully that unfortunately, I think because there's such taboo against certain things, some people will be turned off.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, it depends on at what point somebody is like bothered by something. Like, are they going to be bothered by the fact that you have, you know, an interracial couple kissing on, you know, on the page? Hopefully not.
Yeah.
You know, it's, but it's, if you can, like you're saying, if you've thought of it, mm-hmm, then why not just create it? Because, yeah, I mean, like, you know, when I think of things like, there's a raccoon that shoots a machine gun. I mean, you
exactly
know, like if we can have that, like, why is that, like, perfectly accessible,
yeah,
to every audience and nobody gives it any thought?
Yeah.
And, you know, and you can have the Green Lantern Corps and all the Lantern people, you know, alien races. There's, like,
yeah,
you know, millions of them.
Yeah,
it's like, and you don't give that any thought at all. But it's,
yeah,
like, oh my God, they had, like, I think a like Middle Eastern looking Green Lantern or something, and they gave him a very sort of, like, you know, Islamic sounding name. I don't know if the guy was Muslim or not,
yeah,
but it was like people freaked the hell out,
yeah,
because it was like, oh, but he's like, you know, it's like, oh, but it's okay that you have one that's purple.
Yeah, yeah, that's, yeah, they're cool. We're down with that.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, if you're gonna have that kind of argument, say, hey, why does Sector, you know, 2814 need so many lanterns? You know, don't, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, it's one of those things where I don't know. It was something I considered for a little while, and I was like, you know, people are always saying get diversity in comics, but then the other people are just like, oh, you know, why are you doing that? That's, we don't like it, or it's just a ploy, you're just doing the cash in, or, you know, why couldn't it be a white guy? And in the end, I sort of weighed it up in my head, and it probably took about 3 seconds where I'm like, if anyone's going to complain that my lead character is black, then don't read my book. Don't read any of my books, please. Like, it shouldn't be an issue. And I don't know, as soon as it came into my head, that's just how I saw the character. And I was just like, yeah. And then Eric drew him, and I was like, oh, my God. Like, I see
this. He's designed really well.
Oh, yeah. I like that he doesn't look like Samuel L. Jackson. He doesn't look like anybody. He's just a character, the way any other character is created, the way our dog-headed bartender is created. They're all just these characters. And once I saw him that way, I was just like, yeah, that's done. And I saw it forevermore. And, I mean, I'm breaking a story on another pitch moving forward where the lead character is gay, and not through any, it wasn't even a specific thing, it was just, that's just how he came out. And I don't know why it doesn't happen more, because it's a thing that pops up. I mean, I think I saw on your Facebook recently, you were talking about which female tropes you wanted to get rid of. What was the one you wanted to get rid of?
To me, it was the metal armor bikini, which is completely impractical.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fun. Like, sometimes it's just, like, fun for a fantasy story or whatever, like Deja Thoris, you know, whatever. Yeah. It's supposed to, she's not wearing armor to be protective, but when you look at somebody like Red Sonja or Princess Leia, I mean, Princess Leia was a slave. To me, if anybody's going to earn the right to wear a metal bikini, it's Princess Leia.
Yeah,
because
she was
a slave. Yeah. She was forced to wear it. It was not in her wardrobe.
Yeah.
And, you know, she killed the motherfucker who put her in it.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly. But Red Sonja doing it is...
people have studied armor. People, I mean, at this point in time, people have studied armor and have shown what women would be wearing. They would not actually have the boob cups, because that would actually crush inward.
Yeah,
if it was to get hit, and would actually cause way more damage. So there's, you know, especially like, because Renaissance fairs are really big out here. I don't know what you guys have, you know, but Renaissance fairs are really big. People study armor.
Yeah.
So that was the thing that I wanted to get rid of. I was like, I just, you know, I'm ready for that to be done. And one of the things about in Headspace I noticed was, it's like, wow, these characters are not like roided up. And they're not, you know, back-breaking, you know, like the Shane's wife wasn't some ridiculous bombshell. She was just a pretty lady.
Yeah, Eric's great with that. And the Max design, he's not some, buffed, he's not some huge dude. He just kind of looks like a pretty average dude, which I really like. And, I mean, in the next issue, we introduce an old guy, so I hope people don't hate old guys, like... It's we were trying to create real world people, and I can remember working on Ghost Town with Daniel J. Logan, and I was like, we need this character to be introduced, and he was like, cool, can we just make sure that we make her look normal, because the last thing any book needs is another pretty person. And I was like, yeah, that's so cool.
Yeah,
I'm like, that is an awesome idea. I was like, you're the best, Daniel, you're the best. Like, it's got to happen. You've got to sort of, I don't know, fiction is escapism, and fiction is sometimes, I mean, depending on what you're looking at, is representing the best in people, and quite often it's representing the worst, but it very rarely just seems to represent what's around us. Like, if I look on my street, and I look at the different ethnicities that are living in this one street, and the different ages, and the ages between couples, and I don't know, I don't think I would call any guy on my street buff. Myself included, unfortunately. But it's they're not the people that we come across. Like, you come across different sizes and shapes. And I don't know, I think it's important to reflect that in fiction. And sometimes it is really well, and then sometimes, I don't know, as you say, like, you look at the cast of a certain book and you're just like, that's just a lot of really pretty white people. And
yeah.
Unless you're writing the OC and you're playing into that whole, yep, that's where the pretty white people live, it just starts to feel a bit inauthentic.
Well, it's even noticeable just, you know, through the generations. I mean, obviously superheroes are meant to be examples of perfection and stuff. But, like, when I look at James Bond, who is kind of a superhero, you know, he's like, he's got the Batman gadgets.
Yeah.
But when you go back and you look at old James Bond movies, those freaking actors look nothing like an actor of today.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Like, they would have to be in a gym for 8 hours a day.
Yeah.
you know, but they were still found very sexy and very appealing and to have all the charisma in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And there was nothing wrong, you know, it's like,
not beautiful.
Yeah. It's just, it is. It's nice and refreshing when you can see artists sort of take that and just say, you know, okay, yeah, even if we don't need a character to, you know, we don't need a character to be obese, he's the sheriff.
Yeah.
But we want him to look like a guy who can be a sheriff.
Yeah, yeah.
It was awesome.
Yeah, that's, I think that's a really big thing that Eric and then Chris bring to the game, where they're just like, we're just interested in drawing like real stuff and good stuff and not just, I don't know, I can remember in the 90s, it was probably mid-late 90s, one of the big things I bought out of comics from, I was a big Marvel reader. And I think it was during the Onslaught saga, Reed Richards comes out and he's just shredded. He's huge and he's buff. And I was like, what?
It was bizarre.
Scientist who can stretch? He buff.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, it made no sense. He should be like lanky and skinny. Yeah.
It just sort of annoyed me. And I was like, yeah, there's just not, I just don't need more of that. Unless it's a conscious, like it's for that character. Like that's their background. Like you're writing about someone who goes to the gym, you put it in there. But otherwise, yeah. And unfortunately, it is represented, as you're saying, like today's actors. You look at like Ryan Gosling. Why does he need to be that buff?
Yeah, I mean it's ridiculous. Like I think of, you know, like even those vampire movies and stuff like that, and Chris Hemsworth and like Captain Kirk. Like you look at today's Captain Kirk versus old Captain Kirk.
That is a great comparison.
And it was just like, Shatner never had a six-pack.
No. And he just like...
And this guy, man, he's got like, you know, an eight-pack rocking. It's like,
yeah.
Oh.
It just seems a bit weird. I don't know. It always takes me out because I'm like, I've had stints in my life where I've gotten fit and I used to be a really big long-distance runner and would like to think I got my body to some point of peak physical condition, but I never pushed it to the point of like shredding an eight pack out. Like to do that, you have to so ridiculously focus on that. You're not focused on getting fit
and nothing else.
You're not focused on having a life. I actually had a mate recently who was like, my resolution is to get a six pack this year. And he went about and he did it. God bless him. He did it. But he had to commit every like thought every day to it. Everything you put in his mouth, and you'd go around there and he'd be like, oh, I just got to go out for a run. And then he'd be doing sit-ups and then he'd be doing kettlebells and he'd be doing all this sort of stuff. And he got it. But I was like, oh, I could never spend my time doing that. And we all sort of said to him, are you going to keep it? And he was like, oh, hell no.
Yeah.
He was like, this looks great. And I'm going to get some photos. And then I'm just going to have like a liter of ice cream because
yeah,
Bravo
to him.
The word around to it. So whenever I think of a character and I'm like, and I do it with superheroes all the time. I'm like, the Punisher, he does that in his spare time. I'm like, I'm down with that. But I don't imagine, like, Matt Murdock being like, oh, I got to get my abs. Like, I got to really shred these abs down. He'd be fit, and they work out, and they keep on top of their game, but they don't. You look at, like, fit Olympians. Not all of them have that defined, chiseled six-pack. I mean, they had that image photo sort of board go out a few years ago, I think, where they showed the body types of all the different Olympians.
I was going to say it depended on the sport.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the gymnasts, it's very different than those guys who do the heavy weightlifting competitions.
Yeah, yeah. Your runners and then your divers and then your pole vaulters are all different, but they're all like at peak performance what they do, but they don't all look the same. And I don't know, that always takes me out with stories where I look at a character and I'm like, how does he have time to have the day job and have a wife, but he's got the six-pack? I'm like, that takes time. I mean, there are some people, and bless them, just genetically have a six-pack. They could be sitting around, you know, drinking lard milkshakes, and their body just processed. But they are few in between, and we hate them passionately. So.
Yes, exactly. they are not allowed in our zombie bunker.
No. So, I mean, it's out there, but mostly it's just, I don't know, little things like that start to take me out of the story and out of movies and stuff like that. Like when you see, Amityville Horror with Ryan Reynolds is a really big example where he takes the shirt off and he's chopping the axe, chopping the wood. And I'm just like, how does a dad have time to have a body like that? Like, he'd be in the gym nonstop. Like, I openly, like, I said to my wife, if you want me to be, you know, six-pack Harry, I'll do it, but we will never, ever, ever spend time together because I'll be at the gym. And she was like, well, to be honest, I'm quite a hairy guy, so I could have a six-pack and you wouldn't see it. So motivation is always...
At least you're honest.
Or as I tell people, I have a six-pack. It's just under there. You can't see it.
You can't see it.
It's fooling no one, unfortunately. But I don't know. Yeah, it's one of those things where I'm just like, I don't know. I very rarely write, like, he's got to have the six-pack. And I try not to write females where I'm like, oh, and she's dropped dead, double D's and, you know, hourglass figure. I'm like, just, I'm like, I rarely sort of describe looks of people even. I'm just sort of like, oh, they should have this sort of feel to them. Run with that. I don't know. I think a little part of me likes drawing sort of skinny, lanky dudes, because then I'm like, yeah, that's me. That's me on the page. All right. Sort of push a little my own sort of persona. I mean, I look at Brian K. Vaughan's Why the Last Man and Yorick.
Yeah.
Perfect character. He didn't need to have a six-pack. It didn't fit the character. Wasn't going to fit the story.
But when they cast him for the TV show, how much do you want to bet that he's going to be some, like, you know, Hollywood sweetheart with, you know, it's when Hollywood gets a hold of it, too, it's just such a different creature at that point. You've lost a lot of authenticity with some of them.
It's, yeah, it just becomes a much more a visual medium, and they'll have, like, that's why I love Arrow. And just watching old mate do the pull ups with that bar, and he's like climbing
people.
That's such a ridiculous thing to be doing. It's just a complete ab show off, and I'm like, cool, go for it. Yeah, I mean, I guess it fits the character in the show because he's so driven, and that's all he's doing.
Because that's what he's supposed to be. But that's just it. It's sort of like, you know, it makes sense. That's what he's doing. Like every once in a while, like on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, they would show Buffy working out and doing her training exercises and stuff. And they do that in Batman a lot too.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, okay, well, that's awesome. That's what they need to do. But you know what? It's not something every character needs to do. Like if you're writing a story about, I don't know, an accountant.
Yeah.
You know, or a hacker. Yeah. I'm sorry. I work with people who sit in cubicles and are nerds and don't look up. They, you know, some of them might. Some of them, you know, they're not all. Some of them care, but very few of them do. A lot of them are just like lost track of time. They don't know what's going on. They're plugged in and.
Oh man.
And that's it.
When I'm writing, I'm lucky to have like a drink of water when I should. No less like stop and go. Oh, I better work. Better work the obliques. Better get in the right. Although I'm hoping when this podcast drops, I'm just hoping you get a lot of accountants and hackers start posting ab selfies to you on Twitter.
Ab selfies? We'll have to make a contest or something.
I actually saw my first ab selfie on Facebook this year.
Oh, see that? Okay, just for this year. I was going to say because. It's like, I don't know what it is with like dude bros,
yeah,
but it's like the dude bro persona. It's like, it's always them with like their shirt lifted up. It's like, dude, what are you doing?
Yeah. It's a bunch of them with mates. And then you just see the dude bro in the corner lifting his shirt up. And I'm like,
lifting his shirt.
It's just the cry for attention. You just realize it's just,
it's like no matter what,
these abs, unless they're going to be appreciated. Somebody please look at them.
I don't know, but it's just, yeah, it's just a weird funny thing. And it's like, and sometimes it's not what your character is about. And if your character is you know, if it's about his brains, you know, a character like Reed Richards, and here, you know, in Headspace, it's like we've got Max, who we don't really know anything about yet in issue one. We don't know much at all, but you know, we're living inside the mind of a serial killer at this point. So at this, it's somebody whose mind is very important, and it's not, you know, if Max has a six pack, I don't give a shit.
Yeah.
I mean, unless it matters, like that sort of De Niro taxi driver thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I can go on record and say that Max would not have a really defined six pack, but he would be fit and lean. He would be fit. There's not a little tub on his gut, but I don't think he spent his spare time getting 0% body fat down there. I'm going to go on record and say that.
Okay, because I don't know where Max is. If Max has done prison time, you know, maybe he's got nothing else to do.
That baffles me that we give prisoners gyms.
Gyms and education. Yeah, I know.
But I'm always just like, I'm all for giving them books, but my brother's a prison guard. And he's like, I don't understand why we make these violent, upset people the time to become, like, physical weapons. So that if they want to turn around and just, like, trash a guard, they can. Like, he's said that there's some people in there that are very big, very large. And, like, man, I wouldn't want to go as a guard in there. I'd get torn apart. Like, I don't know why we give them, like, keep them healthy, sure. But I also, like, he talks about they get, big disposable razors, and that's one of their rights. They're allowed to shave. Yet, nearly daily, one of them will break the razor housing open, and then they will have a little blade, and then they will do something with it. And I'm like, you could solve this problem by not giving them razor blades. And he was like, yeah, if only. That's one of their, you know, their rights. I'd walk them into, like, the barber once a week and just trim their beard. That's as good as it's going to get, champ. Like, it always baffles me that they're, because they do. They take the blades out and they swallow them just so they can go to the infirmary and get a bit of attention and get off the cell block. And I'm like, isn't that a hassle? And my brother's just shaking his head and being like, yeah, it is. Yeah, it's a real hassle, but you can't change those things.
But when they're, when they're in there for, 50 to life, what else they got going?
Yeah, they're just sort of trying to just see what can happen. And he does, he just says they're just testing the boundaries and the perimeters constantly, just seeing what will happen. And, oh, man, I couldn't do it. I love talking to my brother about the prison, but I could never do it. It's the same. My wife, she works in drug and alcohol rehabilitation, and she actually works in a methadone dosing clinic for, drug addicts. And the story she comes out with where they're like, oh, yeah, the cops are picking on me. Oh, I was only like 30 above the speed limit when I was driving, or, I was only a little bit drunk. And it's just like, they're not picking on you. They're enforcing laws that you choose to ignore. Like, I would last in that job about an hour before I would pick a verbal fight or something. Like, yeah, and she's amazing at it. God bless her. She's very non-confrontational. And they'll come in and be like, oh, these fucking bricks and blah, 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 blah. She's like, oh, yeah, it's terrible, isn't it? Oh, the cops, yeah, they're the worst. Like, she would just say whatever, and you deal with them for 3 minutes, give them their methadone, and send them on their way. I couldn't do it. Like, I have too much of a mouth on me, unfortunately. It's one of those things where I'd be like, no, maybe you should stop, and then it would escalate. I would just need to curb myself every now and then. I was going to say before as well, if Headspace is ever picked up for TV or film, I really hope they don't pick. Well, they can pick someone with a six pack. Just don't show it. Don't have the good.
Yeah, it's just not necessary. Yeah, it's unless if there's some sort of romantic scene or shower scene. I don't know. It's like, is it gratuitous or is it part of the story?
Yeah.
Like, is it only so that we can see this dude in the shower, which we don't see enough?
Yeah. If it's just for no reason, or just showing them changing their shirt for no reason.
Yeah. Like that scene in the new Star Trek where, like, the chick is in her underwear. It's completely gratuitous.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, it's not that she's not beautiful. It's just, it was pointless. It served no purpose.
Yeah, if it's not helpful, then it's kind of skeezy. I try to steer away from that. I don't think we have any real nudity in this first issue. And I'm sort of thinking forward, and it's not the story we're writing, that's for sure.
Well, see, that's because we don't know about the serial killer stuff yet.
Yeah.
So I mean, it could be like, I've read a couple, serial killer stories. I mean, well, first of all, there's the Joker level stuff, which is the most heinous character of all time, but then there's the Green River Killer.
That is a great book.
Oh, it was amazing. It was tough to read.
Yeah.
It was tough to read because this shit happened.
Yeah.
And, and the art was, like, really perfect for it. They aged the characters because they were constantly, like you were talking about going back and forth with things.
Yeah.
And it didn't have captions because you didn't need them, because the art worked so well in illustrating, well, this is this guy younger and this is this guy older.
Yeah.
Here, it's about, this person's mind and his motivations and stuff, and we don't know anything about him. So, what is it to you that makes a criminal like this so fascinating?
Anyone that that can and does murder. I don't know, I find that it's just so far out of my sort of realm, my sphere of this world. It's interesting to sort of explore why they do it. And I mean, you look at Max in this story, at the moment he's just sort of on the run. And yeah, it is a little oblique. We don't really know exactly why, but he's a man who is open to the idea of killing, and it's just sort of one of those things that happens. He's an interesting and complex guy, and we definitely get more into how he does things and why as the story unfolds moving forward. But yeah, he's just one of those guys who it's like he's not insane. He's functioning. He would come across as normal, but he's relatively reserved, and he's quiet, and he's not too boisterous or bombastic about his lifestyle or about how things happen. He's very comfortable with death, and I don't know, someone that can just be very easy with it. I won't say it scares me, but it rattles me, and it's just one of those things where I'm like, I just can't imagine being that just laissez-faire with it, I guess, would be the idea, where they're just, yeah, you know, it happens. And I want this story to feel, as much as it is kind of science fiction and it's quite fantastical, I do want it to feel grounded in the motivations and the consequences of actions. Whereas when you look at Shane, who is the polar opposite, where at the opening of the story, he talks about we don't kill, and he's very adamant, and that is one of his prime tenets as a character. He does not believe in killing. He does not believe that that is a way forward in any situation, and that's very important to who he is. He's not comfortable with it, and he does not want to go down that path. And so we have the opposite, which is Max, where he's just like, he's not lashing out to do it. He's just like, well, it happens. You know, death is a part of the world sort of thing. So yeah, they're very sort of polar opposite characters in that respect. And so it's sort of fun to make them slowly butt heads as the story moves forward, because they have such different views and beliefs of the world. I don't know, I was very conscious, I didn't want to make Max this sort of wild nutcase. That's not who I wanted him to be.
Okay, because that's, it's interesting because our American news, anyway, like yeah. every other day or pretty much every day is a, you know, like some sort of shooting. You
yeah.
know? Whether it's a mass shooting, which I think needs to be like 4 victims and above.
Yeah.
But, you know, but there's always like a school shooting. But, you know, some of the most horrific ones obviously are when, you know, when it is a group number, you yeah. know, like the lunatic that goes into the movie theater and shoots it up or yeah. into the school and shoots it up. And it always comes back to mental illness. Always. It's never not come back to mental illness.
Yeah.
Whereas if somebody goes and holds up a liquor store, they don't bring it up.
Yeah.
And I don't know what's the difference? Like, and it's like, okay, that guy like robbed you and maybe shot the clerk or whatever. And that doesn't come out as a concern.
Yeah, that's true. That's a really good point where it's just, those people are, you know, those people are bad and mean, and they just rob people. But then when it gets to a larger scale, it's like, oh, yeah, brain meltdown there. It must have been video games. Definitely the comic books too.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I've never really thought about that, where they just talk about, you know, when it's on a smaller scale, it's treated in a different way.
It depends. Yeah, it's like, well, especially if it's just like a lonely white kid, then it's obviously the kid was bullied and tormented.
Yeah.
Like, well, who the hell isn't?
Exactly.
You know, who went through their teenage years and didn't feel like shit?
Yeah. That's like, yeah, I always sort of have trouble seeing those things where they're just like, oh, let's quickly make an excuse for it. And in the end, I worry that that culture then, it builds the killers, then they get to feel like the victims afterwards as well and go, oh, it wasn't my fault. It is. You're making
it sets them up for an amazing legal defense is all it does.
Yeah. I always sort of, I mean, I'm a teacher, I'm a primary school teacher, and I see kids at that, I haven't seen any shootings, but I see kids at that age that do, they make an excuse. I've had kids do terrible things to other students in the school, and they go, oh, you know, it's because, you know, and one kid used to say, oh, you know, it's because, and he would cite something that happened when he was one. And he was told about it, and yeah, it sounded like it was a terrible situation. I feel for him, but he knew he could bring it up as a thing. And I'm just like, I don't know. I have this discussion with my wife a bit, and she does. She thinks I'm a little bit cold on this front, because some kids will say, "Oh, you know, it's because, you know, my mum's sick or whatever, and that's why I punched a kid." When I was in primary school, my father died, and I never once used it as an excuse to do anything. And I even very, and at that age, and I was about 5 or 6 when it occurred, and in the early resulting years, I was very conscious. I would not use it as an excuse. I would not use it to not hand in homework. I would not use it so that I could snipe at other kids or be mean or even get into physical altercations, because I felt like it was my problem and I would deal with it. And I dealt with it, I guess, probably by bottling it up, which works for some, doesn't work for others, probably won't work.
And you became a writer.
Yeah, and now I spew it onto the page. But, you know, I see people that make these excuses, and then I look at society and I'm like, yeah, it's endemic. They make excuses there where they're like, oh, you know, it's because, you look at all the furor now about, you know, the kids will only thrive if they have both parents, a mother and a father in the home. And you can't have single parents and you can't have gay parents. And I'm like, that's shit. That is a whole bunch of horse shit. Like, that's just excuse making. Like, people thrive fine. Like, my father died when I was 5. I turned out fine. I was raised just by my mother. Like, you can fall back on things. And sometimes it is. And I will admit, and this is where my wife disagrees with me, where she's like, no, you got through it. Not everybody gets through it. And I'm like, all right, okay, yeah, people have different abilities to cope with things, and people react differently to the same thing that can occur. So I get that, but I don't know. I just don't like excuses, which makes me a hard-ass teacher. They always sort of, they know.
It does sound like you would be a pretty hard teacher.
Yeah, if a problem comes to me, I'm like, no, you did this, and this is the consequence. And I build great relationships with kids, and I'm very fair, and I'm to the line, and I don't become vindictive and go, oh, this is your third strike, that's it. I'm going to get the rusty bike chain out, and you're not going to like it. Like, it's not personal, but I'll just say, here's the line, here's where you crossed it, this is how it goes, and sort of, I'm not about excuse making. And, I mean, even thinking about that, I'm thinking about Max. He doesn't make excuses. I'll give him that as a character. He's not an excuse maker in the slightest.
Okay, so we don't have to, I mean, it depends on where we're coming from, because like I said, we don't know much about Max, but it's like, there's so many tropes, like, his mother molested him, or yeah, his mother didn't molest him, but kept him, you know, under strict control with her Bible talk something.
Yeah. No, none of that. None of that in Max's backstory, which will come out. I'm trying to think of what issue we reveal. It's issue 4 or 5, where you will come to know exactly where Max is coming from and what informs him now. You'll very clearly have that sort of spelled out for you. And yeah, it's nothing like that, that's for sure. And it's certainly not, there'll be no excuses made around it, which I hadn't really thought about before, but just having this discussion, yeah, I'm realizing, and I feel really good about that now. It's not going to fall back that, you know, somebody molested him and now he's lashing out at the world. There's none of that. None of that whatsoever. No, he'll firmly take responsibility for his actions. I feel really good about that. Thank you.
You're welcome. I can't wait. How many issues do you have planned?
It's going to be 8 in total.
Okay.
Yeah, so it'll run throughout the entire year, and we very much have a firm end point where everything sort of wraps up and everything comes together. That was sort of one of the things we set in place early, where I was like, this is where we build to, this is where it goes. And Eric and a good friend of mine and a story breaker, a supreme that I trust completely, Dan Hill, who is our editor on this project. We told him the ending, and he was like, oh, that's brilliant. That's going to look amazing. That's going to wrap everything up. That's going to be satisfying. Great. So, yeah, we always sort of wanted to build to that point. And I can't wait to get there, to be honest. And so we're just sort of making sure that every issue has things that it's just like, well, we're getting there. And hopefully, I don't know, it's one of those things where I want it to be an emotional beat. I like a good emotional beat. I like a good emotional end to my stories. And so I think on that last page, it will grab people. That's the plan.
Return the Hulk.
Now, is it going to be throughout the 8 issues that you have the tag team between the art teams because of flashbacks, or was that something just specifically for the beginning of the story?
No, that will be moving forward completely. Chris and Marissa will handle the in real life sequence going right until the end, and Eric will focus purely on Carpenter Cove and their headspace. Issue 2, actually, we don't have a Max in real life sequence, just in sort of structuring it. He doesn't pop up, and then he's in every other issue moving forward. So, yeah, we will be having the split art thing.
Okay, because one of the things that I noticed, aside from, the art style itself changes as far as conceptually, was the color palette changed.
Yeah.
Now, how much direction did you give for that,
We all discussed it, but it was a very conscious decision.
Okay, it was like really like blue and green in Shane's world. And then when we get out, there's like bright sunny yellow with like mint green, like a pastel green.
Yeah.
So it was like really different. You knew that you were in different places.
That's one reason I wanted it to feel like different places, but I wanted the different places to have very different tones to them. So I wanted to make sure that Carpenter Cove just doesn't feel right. Doesn't feel good. Doesn't feel like home. Doesn't feel welcoming. And it's not. Anyway, and then the real world, I like that it's a little more pop, a little more upbeat, but that's where we're dealing with the killer. I sort of like that.
Yeah, which is really strange that's the happy looking place is where it's not.
Yeah.
Is Marissa specifically the color artist only for Chris's work?
Just for Chris, yeah. Eric colors his own work.
Eric colors his own. Okay.
Yeah. He's a wizard. He can basically do it all. He letters the entire book as well. He knows how to lay things out. He's going to figure out how to write, and then I'm fucked.
Then you're done.
Yeah.
Then there.
He has no need for me anymore because I love his stuff, and
maybe he'll let you write the forward.
Maybe, yeah, that'd be nice. That'd be really nice of him. I'll ride those coattails, absolutely. Because, I feel like, I mean, both of these guys on the art team are destined for more.
I love Chris's work.
Yeah, I mean, he's had a bit of work with Dark Horse, and he's done a lot of other sort of DIY stuff. And I don't know if it's been announced, so I won't steal his thunder. But he's got other things coming up. And, he's a name that's not going anywhere. And same with Eric. I really dig Eric's style, and the fact that he's so concerned with story and with how the story sort of flows on the page and how things happen. And I know I gave him a note on this issue. I was like, oh, can we change this line? And he was like, oh, I've really got his face expressing the other line. And I was like, that's really awesome. I was like, I really like
okay.
that. You really sound. I was like, yeah, absolutely. We don't need to change the line. I said that what I need to happen can come in another place. Totally. And it's good collaborating with him in that way where he'll be like, oh, can we do it a different way? He'll sort of challenge it. There is no top down on this project. It is a real collaboration, which I like. And then, I mean, talking about going places, Marissa, is somebody who I think her work is phenomenal. And I love that she puts a lot of thought into things as well. And she really sort of comes up with palettes, and then it's like, all right, are we cool with these sort of range of colors? And then she goes in, and the way she applies them, I think, is really gorgeous. And she's another one who's conscious of having that diversity on show as well. And if you look through her sequence with Chris, you'll see all the colors of the rainbow when people are concerned. And I think that that's really cool. Where she's sort of happy to just go, let's reflect a bit of what's around us. And I'm doing a few other projects with her sort of coming down the pike, and she's just doing top shelf stuff. She's another one of those collaborators where I'm like, I better like work with her as much as possible now because she'll be out of my league later. So
where did you find them? Because I do want to talk about, stuff that you have coming up, but since we're talking about this incredible team together and you guys have such this, amazing relationship, how did you, all come together?
Eric, I knew on Twitter. He's one of the Canadian crew of comic makers. I probably met him through Ed Brisson, I would say, because he's done a short story with Ed on Challenger Comics. We started following each other, and then he sent me a DM and was like, "Hey man, you got any stuff coming up? You want to do some collaboration?" And sort of we got into a chat that way. Chris, he just did a one shot with Jeremy Holt, so he's just
right,
he's
like blows my mind.
Oh, Holt, yeah, his work on that was dynamite. Oh,
love it.
So he's sort of in that Twitter circle where there's a whole bunch of us that are all sort of very tight online and chat and email back and forth. So both the artists sort of, I think, just fell into that where I couldn't even tell you where or when I started following them or when they started following me. We've just sort of been a part of this wide cast net crew for a while. But Marissa, I met through Jason Lewis, a colorist who's done some work here and there, and I was online looking for a colorist for another project, and he shot me a DM, was like, "I know this lady, she does great work, do you want to get in touch with her?" And so I started chatting to Marissa that way. So another Twitter hookup, but we weren't following each other yet, but I fell in love with her work instantly, and so we started doing some different things, and yeah, she really sort of, she varies things per project, and she's very collaborative, and she'll talk and she will discuss things with the artist. She's amazing to work with. From a writer standpoint, she's amazing, and I know the artists feel the same way too.
I had read a really crazy thread. My friend Paul Aller had a really interesting conversation going where, for whatever reason, the people doing color on a project had not been, they don't get scripts. And I'm like, how can your people doing color not get scripts? How do they know what stuff is? Unless, you know, I mean, obviously I can see, like, you know, somebody gives them concept sketches or character sketches and designs and stuff. That's one thing. Yeah. But how do they know if it's day or night? How do they know what the mood is? How do they, you know, like, how are they doing this?
I don't understand how that would work.
And several, you know, like, you know, a couple of the people that were there were saying, yeah, I flat and I don't get any scripts and I do color and I don't get any scripts. Like, that seems like the most bizarre thing to me. It's like, really? Do you give scripts to your letterer? Because I just can't even imagine.
I couldn't imagine getting art and just that alone and someone just being like, just color this in. I'd be scared.
Yeah, it could be
so many ways to do things totally against what it should be, like you say, day and night, things like that. And yeah, it would worry me. I would just ask for the script. There's no way I'd know how to do it moving forward.
And there's just such a broad range, just the variation alone. Like, you have guys that do, and I mean, I just say guys generally.
Yeah,
you have guys that do stuff that's very muted, like, you know, like Westerns are very often done with, like, there's not deep saturation.
Yeah.
You know, and more with very earthy tones, and you don't see, like, shocking blood red, you know, like, everything's, and then you've got stuff that's, like, really primary and bright and, like, Art and Franco work. I mean,
yeah,
you know, like,
yeah, exactly. There's so many different ways that things can be done. I don't know. The more I've worked in comics and the more I've worked with art teams and colorists, the more I've really adapted my script style, where a lot of the times I will just sort of, you know, I'll state whether it's day or night. And then if I were to just do that, I would totally trust Marissa to then know, like, what to do with the page and what she wanted to do with the page. But every now and then I'll put in, like, a little note, like, should we make the background on this panel all red or orange? Marissa, do you want to chat about it? And I'll leave that in the script. And then, or I'll write, like, Marissa, you make a choice, or if you want, we can chat about it. And usually, like, she'll just sort of run with it. And her instincts, there's not been a lot of times that I've had to question any choices on the page. I'm trying to even think if I've ever had to. She just sort of knows what looks good and what works and what will fuel the narrative. I feel like her coloring, she's one of those colorers that... She's really part of the storytelling team, and so she'll bring things together. I mean, you look at, there's a sequence early in the book where Max is on the run from some government agents, And he basically, he goes on the attack. He's killing a few of them. And at the top of the page, we've got this sort of like this yellow panel, and then we have an orange panel in the middle of the page, and then down the bottom, one of the panels is like blood red. I just saw that page and was like, done, cool. I didn't script any of that. I wish I could take the credit for it. That's all Marissa, and it looks amazing on the page, but it also fits with what's occurring in the story. And that's what it's like working with her. She just runs with it. And, I mean, I think I sent her an email after the first page where she colored a bunch of stuff, and I was like, oh, we need Max's shirt to be red because that will gel with something that occurs elsewhere in the story. But otherwise, I said, I totally trust you as an artist and as a storyteller to just run with it. I said, if there's any notes in the script that you want to chat about, let's do it. Otherwise, why would I tell like her how to do something that she's amazing at and I got no idea? Like I'm not an artist. I always feel really uncomfortable asking for changes, purely because is what I'm suggesting better? Does it work? Like, I sort of start to doubt myself. I mean, I count myself as a...
No, I think you should trust your artists. They you know, they're schooled in this.
Yeah. Like, I'm a savvy reader, and I know what I like, but... And I like Marissa's work, so that always works. But every now and then I'll be like, oh, no, like, there's... like, they're doing thumbnails moving forward. There was one page where I sent Eric a note and was like, oh, can we actually mix this up and do it this other way? And he was like, oh, yeah, cool. And there was a page in the first issue where and this is usually when it happens, and this is why I like seeing thumbnails. If my script isn't clear, if I've written it poorly, the artist may think I mean something else. And so there was the splash page early on in this where, I think it's page 3, where Shane is kicking Linda out into the waters off Carpenter Cove. And Eric laid it out, and I was like, oh, and I read my script panel description. I was like, oh, I missed like one key thing that I meant to write. I was like, can we actually structure it this way? And Eric was like, yeah, cool. And we catch it in thumbnail stage, and that's easy. That's why I always ask my artists if I can see the thumbnails first. And I worry that they're like, oh God, he's going to be a control freak and have a bunch of notes. And I only ever do it because sometimes I'm worried I haven't been clear enough with how I've written the panel description. And maybe it'll be.
I think that's a really valid point.
Yeah.
That is a really, really valid point, that it's not that you're doubting them, but you're questioning your direction.
Yeah, I'm doubting myself, always. So, yeah, I'll look over their thumbnails. I mean, if I look at Chris's pages, there are a few times where, and he asked up front, he's like, are you cool if I, like, structure this or add a panel or whatever, or, you know, subtract a panel? And I'm like, yes. And that's my deal with every artist. I'm like, yeah, it's your page, man. And he did. He added panels here and there, and he would change, like, I don't write too many, I guess you would call camera sort of directions.
Right.
I don't think I write too many of those. Every now and then I'll be like, oh, this would be cool if it was maybe a wide panel. Like, I do see pages visually in my head, but if an artist doesn't deliver what I saw in my head, but the page still looks amazing and works, I don't call them on it. I'll just be like, and usually they do it better because that's their job and that's what they're awesome at. But I'll sort of let it go. But every now and then I'll be like, oh, you're meant to see, you know, the gun on the counter, because that'll go off in the third act. And they'll be like, oh, okay, well, you know, script it better next time, dumbass, and we'll move forward.
I love that.
But with this, it's just been so easy, where Eric brings amazing game, and then Chris is design and his actual, you know, line work is just superb. And then the way both Eric and Marissa color it, it all just comes together where it's fueling the story and you're hopefully getting a sense of tone, which I think is really important in comics. The more I read comics, the more I'm like, color can make or break a book, like unbelievably so. And so we really want it to make this book. I don't want it to be poorly colored. And quite thankfully, it is not, which makes me very happy. I hope that when it gets reviewed that people mention the color. I'd like that. It's one of those things that comes up again and again, that, you know, the colorists don't get mentioned. So hopefully with this, especially with the differing styles, they certainly will be and should be.
Yeah, it stood out for me. It's, you know, and like I said, there were things, like you said, you know, talking about the cultural backgrounds of the characters and stuff like that. Like, you know, like every reader might not get that because they're already absorbed in the story that it's not, you know, or it's not different enough to them. Yeah. And if it is different enough, then they'll be like, wow, yeah, why aren't more books like this or, you know, yeah. or something like that. But what's your distribution for this? Who's publishing and how are people going to find it?
Yeah, so it's a Monkey Brain comics book, which is honestly like a dream come true. They're a publisher.
It is awesome. Oh, that's fantastic.
They've only been around about a year and a half, but...
Yeah, they're so great, though.
Their quality, like, they're a publisher where I'm like, I'll try a book because it's a Monkey Brain book. It's an imprint of quality. Where it could be any sort of genre book. I'm just like, if it's attached to this publisher, it's no doubt pretty good. And that's held pretty strong across their line. I didn't think I'd even be able to blip on Monkey Brain's radar for years to come. But Chris Sabella, who writes High Crimes for them, is a handsome devil, a gentleman, and a scholar, and he introduced me to Chris in Emerald City in Seattle earlier last year, which was something he certainly didn't have to do, didn't need to do. It just sort of happened, and he was awesome to do it. And so Chris and I got sort of chatting, and then between Chris Allison and I, they picked up Headspace, and it's really like, it's an amazing place to land. They let the creative team run with it. They let us make so many decisions and have the control. And so it means that we are a digital first book. So it means people can go to Comixology on Wednesday and the book will be there in the digital first row or page, and they can get the book for 99 cents, which is also something that excites me. It means that back end, we're losing out on the millions of dollars that we've
got. Of course you are. That's the Hollywood deal. That's when Hollywood comes in, all right.
1 million per six pack, yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, we made sure that, you know, the first issue is 99 cents. I'm a pretty heavy digital reader. I'm a big Monkey Brain reader. I love that pretty much all their books are 99 cents, and that's what I like to pay for my digital content. So it was very important to me that we kept it at 99 cents. And Eric and everybody sort of agreed that that's what we should do with the book. So, yeah, they can go and they can find it on Comixology. And hopefully everybody realizes, but if you buy from the Comixology website, it means that Apple doesn't take one-third of cover price. So
I did not know that.
Oh, really? Yeah, if you buy a comic through your iPad or through your iPhone on Comixology, Apple automatically takes 33% of whatever you spend. So it's a lot of money, you know, adding it up. So if you go to the Comixology website, comixology.com, you go to the comic, you purchase it there, Apple doesn't get to take that big wet bite out of it, and that leaves 33 cents that gets to be, how I like to feel, more justly distributed. And I do it. I actually go to my local comic book store, Impact Comics. I go to their Comixology page, so they get a tiny slice of the sale. And I buy books there, and then I open up my iPad and I launch Comixology, and under my Purchases tab, the book appears there instantly, and I just press download. And so it takes me maybe an extra minute. Let's round up and say an extra minute, and I know that more of my money goes to the creative team then. So if you can and would like to do that, people, I would really be appreciative. And I know Eric and Chris and Marissa and the rest of us all working back end would be appreciative of a third of your money not being sort of washed away. And I don't want to feel like I'm running Apple out of business, because I'm pretty sure I'm
I think they can
I'm
afford
out
it.
Of business. Yeah, I think they'll be fine. Yeah,
I think they'll be fine. Okay, so I did look up the Twitter information for the rest of the team, but before we do that, what's in the pipeline for you?
Moving
like, do you have...
I can hint at things, absolutely.
Hint at things, okay. Because it's going to be a big year. It is going to be the year of Ryan K. Lindsay.
I can only hope, because I really felt like every year would be, and then someone like Paul Aller would steal the year instead.
You know, that Paul Aller, he's just everywhere. He's going to, you know, he's really going to be one of those, like, recluse types.
Yeah.
That, like, nobody hears from, because he's just so busy cranking out books.
Doing all the books. Yeah, I feel like 2014 is going to be the year of Aller instead of Lindsay. But okay. I'm going to take a run at him. Yeah, later this year, Sammy Cavella and I have a book called Chum that we'll be bringing to a publisher. It's sort of like a beach noir story. It's sort of like my hack at doing like an old gold medal paperback pulp crime story. It's a lot of fun. It's very sort of dark. It's very, very criminal. It's just full of bad people. So I'm really excited. And Marissa is coloring that book, and her coloring a beach crime story is as gorgeous as you think it would be. So yeah, that'll be coming out. We're hoping to launch later this year, and I do believe we will be. And in between now and then, there are two one-shots that I'll be bringing out, sort of DIY style, much like I brought out Fatherhood last year through Challenger Comics. I've got two other one-shots that are getting close to finished with art teams, and Sammy Cavella is working on one, and a good Australian friend of mine, Louis Joyce, is working on another that's a sort of a female kung fu revenge story that I'm really excited to see how he wraps up some of those pages. So those will be coming forward. And other than that, just sort of I'm in the Scam Ultimate Collection.
Oh, big giant, yeah.
Which, as we go to digitization now, is maybe just winding up its Kickstarter campaign. That was awesome to be involved in. So I've got a short there. I've got a few other shorts coming up that I can't talk about. But some exciting things, absolutely.
Great. Well, I think that Marissa's Twitter is at Marissa Draws.
That's the one.
That's the one. And Eric is at EricXYZ.
Yes.
And Chris, I've been following, is Versus Robots,
yes,
correct?
Yes, that's the one. That is the same.
VS Robots. So it's great that I got to add a couple new Twitter people today.
Yeah, and the editor on the project is at Dan_Hill, and he's an amazing sort of story-minded guy. I brought him on because he's smart and he knows structure, and he's a really good editor. He will call me on bullshit and just be like, why is this line this long, or why is this happening? And that's been really healthy. And we also have another guy who's involved, which is Christopher Kosek, who's designing the back matter pages for me, which was important for me. He's at C Kosek, K-O-S-E-K. And I brought him in to design the back matter pages because I didn't want it to look like, you know, print screens of a Word document. I wanted it to sort of look pretty, and he's done this phenomenal job of making it sort of look like a magazine. He's got sort of like these images sort of almost like watermarked in the background and things like that. It's a work of art what he's done back there. He's a really good designer. He designed the whole Fatherhood comic for me, and there's a big reason why it was so eye-catching and looked so good. And I'm sort of working on with him designing other things moving forward. He's a really good guy, but he's just a top-notch designer. So if anyone else out there is looking for a designer for your books and for your credit pages and your back matter, I would hit him up and throw a little cash his way, because I think it's worth it in the long run. I think it's nice to have a pretty package in its totality. I think it's I don't like getting the back matter pages and they're just ghastly. Like I think about High Crimes and their back pages, and I think about Pretty Deadly and their back pages. They look good.
Yeah, they're gorgeous.
Yeah, like they have their own sort of artistic merit as well. So yeah, that's the whole team. It's a sort of juggernaut of a crew there, and they're all really good people to work with, which is nice. And I don't know. I feel like I'm doing the best work of my career so far, a short career that it is. But it's nice to put this book forward with the biggest publisher I've ever worked with, and sort of go, yeah, I stand by this work. It is the best that I am doing right now. I really stand by this book. I think Headspace is everybody firing on all cylinders, as it should be.
Well, Monkey Brain, for people that, you know, want to keep up with announcements and stuff, their Twitter is monkeybrain_INC.
Yes.
And, of course, at monkeybraincomics.com. And you are very easy at Ryan K. Lindsay.
That's right. Don't forget the K, guys. So.
Yeah, because there are a lot of Ryan Lindsays, I got to say.
Yeah, there are a lot of Ryan Lindsays. And they're usually just like a American university like lacrosse players for some reason.
Yeah, it is. Like there might have been a dude bro lifting up his shirt when I was looking.
That was not me.
I was like, I don't think that's him. Oh, there's a K. That's right, I forgot.
That should be my artist biopic. I should do a little ab lift.
I love it.
Destroy some retinas while I'm out there. That'd be just great. No one to pick up any future issues for fear of hitting that last page and seeing the ab lift. There needs to be more ab lifts in comic creators. I want to see this happen.
That should be a thing. You should do that one day.
Nice. I'll work on it.
And you guys can follow me on Twitter at Elizabeth Amber, and of course everything else is at amberunmasked.com. Oh my goodness, Ryan, it's always such a pleasure. So I will definitely, of course, have you back when everything else is ready to come down.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. That is always. We got into some good tangents today, so I would love to see where we go next.
That's fantastic. All right, guys, Vodketeers, thank you for listening, and don't forget to follow all those amazing creators.